15. Philip and Martin spent most of the next 2 days practicing levitating and duplicating objects and going for long walks around Ledchurch. Philip encouraged Martin to ask questions, but was careful in how much new material they covered on a given day. He said he wanted to keep Martin from getting overwhelmed. Martin would leave the embarrassingly oversized loner robe and hat back at the shop. Without the rest of the ensemble, his staff seemed out of place, so it stayed back at the shop as well. Occasionally, one of the locals, as Martin now called them, would ask Philip for some assistance. If they wanted money or food, he'd hear them out, and if he found them worthy, he'd make their chicken into 2 chickens. If they wanted him to predict the future, he'd say something confusing and move along. If they were particularly hard up, he'd say something confusing and make their chicken into 2 chickens. Martin noticed that the locals were falling into 3 distinct categories. People who wanted something and walked right up to ask, people who didn't want something right now but treated Philip in a cordial manner, and people who clearly were up to no good, all of whom seemed to avoid Philip like the plague.
"When I first got here," Martin said, "the first 2 locals I met were a couple of really tough-looking guys. We were on the road, miles from anyone else. I thought they were going to give me trouble, but they seemed terrified of me."
Philip laughed.
"These people have lived with us wizards in their midst for years now. They're all aware of the damage we can do if pushed. Think about how you got here, Martin. Think about all of us other wizards. We got here the same way. Part of why we all get along so well is that we're pretty much the same type of person. Only people who spend more time with computers than with people ever find the file. So we all share similar experiences and attitudes. Regretfully, some of us are still carrying a chip on our shoulder from the playground. And now that we have the power to get some revenge on bullies, some tend to take it too far. There's one spell that causes a 30-foot-tall flaming demon to claw its way out of the ground and give your foe a wedgie. That makes a lasting impression."
"You're saying that the bullies are afraid of the geeks?"
"Specifically, oddly dressed geeks who talk funny. And last night, that described you perfectly."
"So we're allowed to use our powers as a weapon?"
"Only in self-defense. It seldom comes to that. As you've seen, we can make our homes and shops impregnable. And out here in the open, we're unlikely to be taken unawares. If someone does grab me, I can always just say, 'Escuppy!'"
There was a flash of blue light, and Philip was gone. Martin looked around. Everybody on the street was looking at him. Several very large men seemed particularly interested in the now unescorted wizard's apprentice and started walking towards him. There was another flash of light. Philip was back, and suddenly nobody was looking at them anymore. The large men seemed preoccupied with the sky or the ground, anything but Philip and Martin.
"Sorry about that. Anyway, I can say that word, and I'll go to a safe place I set up in advance. In my case, it's..."
"You know what?" Martin interrupted, suddenly aware that people were paying more attention than Philip might realize. "You can show me later."
That afternoon, Martin multitasked, splitting his attention between the Esperanto vocabulary book from the 1930s that Philip had given him and doing quick and dirty alterations on the loner robe and hat. His own robe would not be ready for another week, and he decided he never wanted to be caught in public without the identifying markers of a wizard again. He sat in the shop, speaking gibberish and occasionally jabbing himself with a needle, which didn't break his skin but still hurt. When he was done, he looked himself over, and he had to admit his handiwork looked pretty bad. He looked like he had his tailoring done by an 8-year-old, but at least he didn't look like a victim. He went into the crystal ballroom to show Philip his finished ensemble. Philip agreed that the sewing wasn't great, but that Martin's staff had come out nicely. Martin had stripped off the bark, sanded the pale wood smooth, varnished and sealed the wood, and firmly affixed the 6-inch bust of Santo to the top. The bust had a square base that included Santo's cape chain and collarbones, but cut off his shoulders. His thick, short neck led to his hand-painted mask. It was a dazzling metal flake silver, like the body of a fiberglass dune buggy. The piping around the eyes, nose, and mouth holes was a flatter, duller gray. The eyes of the mask were canted at a fearsome, angry-looking angle, but the human eyes they framed looked kind and gentle. It was totally incongruous, and as such, perfect for Martin's needs. Philip took it all in and said,
"You look like a crazy person."
"Good?" Martin said.
"Very good,"
Philip said.
"And you're just in time. We should really get going."
Martin wasn't aware that they were going anyplace that evening, and said so.
"You've been doing a great job, and I know that what with the consciousness-changing discoveries, police chases, time travel, and wizard training, it's been a stressful couple of weeks for you, so I figured it was time to have some fun."
Martin tried to picture what fun for someone with the kind of powers the wizards have. "Are we going to go flying, or teleport to a historical event?"
"We could do those things if you want. I was thinking we just meet a couple of my friends and spend the evening eating unhealthy food and playing board games."
"Let's do it,"
Martin blurted. Philip smiled.
"Let me tell them we're coming."
Philip gripped his staff in his left hand and held his right hand at head height as if he were performing the Yorick speech from Hamlet. He said,
"Komuniki kungeri."
A glowing sphere of white light appeared in Philip's outstretched hand. It pulsated and emanated an eerie, warbling hum.
"Some of the guys call this spell the hand phone. It's ringing," Philip said.
After a moment, the sphere of light collapsed, changed shape, and became an image of a flaming human skull. It was completely flat, as if it were painted on a sheet of plastic. The flames moved, but not fluidly. It took Martin a moment of mental processing to realize that the image hovering above Philip's hand was an animated GIF file projected into the world like an object. A hollow, distant voice emanated from the flat, flaming skull.
"Who has sought me? I who hold the fates of..." "Oh, hey, Phil. You still coming over?"
"Yeah. I just wanted to let you know we're on our way now."
"Cool. See you then. The location code is Gary La Antawa Corto. Got it?"
Philip said,
"Yeah, see you in a sec,"
and made a fist, causing the flaming skull to disappear. Moments later, Philip and Martin materialized in a small, dark clearing in a forest near the side of a hill. The sun had not quite set, and the countryside beyond the forest was bathed in a golden glow. This chunk of forest, however, was dark and foreboding. What little light filtered in revealed twisted trees with gray bark and brown leaves. The underbrush was damp and smelled of decay. On one side of the clearing, a barely discernible path led into the woods. Trees hung menacingly over the trail, giving the impression of a claustrophobic tunnel. At the other end of the treeless area, the path widened, and the bordering trees provided less cover, as they all seemed to be dead or dying. Three wizards were already there. They seemed very happy to see Philip.
"Gentlemen,"
Philip said.
"Good to see you."
Philip introduced everyone. Gary was tall and thin, with a short beard and large, mischievous eyes, wearing a black robe and hat. Jeff was small but muscular, with a narrow head, prominent nose, and small eyes. His robe appeared to be some sort of gray wool. Tyler was heavier, but by no means fat, with dark skin, short, black, curly hair, a friendly demeanor, and a striped purple and red robe. All three of them were smiling a little too broadly, almost to the point of laughing. Philip frowned and looked down. He was standing ankle deep in a puddle.
"Gary!"
Philip yelled.
"You shouldn't have let Gary know where you would be teleporting," Jeff offered. "Never smart."
"I used the location code he gave me,"
Philip said, looking at his soggy boots.
"Like I said, not smart."
There were spells that could be used to clean items, but nobody had come up with a better means of drying things than time and air, so Philip was doomed to spend the rest of the evening barefoot, prolonging Gary's victory. Tyler looked at Martin's robes.
"Wow, Gwen's work is really slipping."
"Oh, you've all met Gwen?"
"Met. Asked out, and got rejected by," Gary said.
"Yeah, that Gwen,"
Jeff said. "She don't like the wizards."
"She likes me fine,"
Philip said, removing his waterlogged boots and socks.
"But you've never asked her out," Gary said.
"There might be a lesson in that,"
Philip said, looking at Martin.
I don't see the point in getting a woman to like you if you're not going to go out with her.
No, Gary, you wouldn't, Philip said.
Anyway, Martin explained. Gwen's still working on my robe. This is a loaner from Philip.
Tyler looked at the robe again, then cocked an eyebrow at Philip.
Blood red with black trim? That's not your style.
Philip shrugged.
I was in my necromancer phase.
Tyler nodded.
We all go through it.
If you're lucky, you grow out of it.
Jeff said, looking at Gary, who was resplendent in his black robe. When Philip was convinced that his boots were clean, they proceeded into Gary's home. They had walked past the dead trees, round the corner of a steep hill, which blocked their view of what was ahead. They didn't walk far, maybe 100 feet, before a carefully calculated vista opened before Martin, revealing Gary's home. There was a small, perfectly round clearing at the base of a cliff. At the center of the clearing, there was a stone plinth. On the plinth burned a fire so dark blue it was essentially black. The fire cast eerie shadows upward. Martin's eyes were naturally drawn to a twisting path cut into the rock. It switched back on itself twice before terminating about 3 stories up the cliff at a cave opening that formed the mouth of a ghastly skull. The hollows that formed the eyes of the skull glowed faintly red.
Home, sweet home, Gary said as he and Tyler lifted their staffs and flew to the skull's mouth.
Jeff produced a wand and followed them, soaring gracefully through the air. Philip left his boots and socks at the foot of the trail, put a hand on Martin's shoulder, and they both drifted effortlessly to the skull as well. The mouth of the cave was large enough for all 5 of them to stand comfortably.
Welcome to Skull Gullet Cave, Martin. Come on in, Gary said, walking deeper into the cave.
The cave entrance narrowed, then widened again into a chamber about 30 feet around, lit by torches set low on the walls that burned with a smokeless green flame. At the far end, there was a massive throne made entirely out of antlers. Hundreds of sharp points jutted out at chaotic angles. It was the least comfortable-looking chair Martin had ever seen. Next to it, on a pedestal, there was a massive, ancient-looking, leather-bound book held at an angle, waiting to be studied.
I just need to grab something really quick, Gary said as he hoisted the cover of the book open.
Martin was surprised to see light emanate from the pages, illuminating Gary's face with a bluish glow. Martin was less surprised a moment later to hear the book make the classic synthesized bong of a Macintosh computer booting up. Gary lifted a dark gray first-generation Apple PowerBook out of a hollow that was cut into the pages of the book. Gary held his staff in front of him and said,
Mother Love Bone.
Lines of fire formed a rectangle on the cave wall. The stone inside the rectangle disappeared as the fire died out, revealing a room beyond. Gary led the others into the next room. When compared to the cave's exterior and the first room, this room was shockingly normal by comparison. In one corner, there was a roaring fire in a large fireplace, providing heat. There was a table with benches along both sides. There were 3 cushions on each bench to suggest where people should sit and help those people forget that they were sitting on a wooden bench. Light was provided by white balls of light that just hovered in the 4 corners of the room.
I love what you've done with the place, but when people see this room, isn't the effect kind of ruined?
Martin asked.
Nobody but other wizards ever see this room,
Tyler answered.
If a lady wants to come home with me, I transport her directly to the bedroom, Gary said, motioning to a door in the back corner.
And no wizard wants to go in there,
Jeff added quickly. Gary gave Martin the grand tour of the main room, but there wasn't really much to show. Martin was beginning to worry about the Spartan nature of wizards' lives. He didn't like the idea of spending the rest of his life living in barely furnished rooms and eating stew and porridge. As if reading his mind, Gary said,
So, who's hungry?
The answer was everyone. Martin was bracing himself for more stew when Gary said,
Martin, you're the new guy. What do you like? Pepperoni, combo, or plain cheese?
Martin sputtered, then said pepperoni. Gary took off his robe. Beneath it, he was wearing torn jeans, gigantic, loosely laced white high tops, and a black t-shirt that said Dokken. He opened his power book to reveal a small black and white screen, surrounded by a 2-inch thick bezel, a small keyboard, and a marble-sized trackball. Gary typed a few words one-handed and disappeared. Less than a second later, he reappeared holding three large brown boxes from Pizza Hut.
I never get tired of the look on their face when I pick up the pizza and walk directly into the bathroom,
he said, chuckling.
Oh, Gary, I told you not to take my food into the bathroom, Jeff said.
Relax, it's just a private place to teleport.
Still, I don't need my pizza seasoned with bathroom air from 1992.
Martin, what's your favorite soda?
Diet Coke? Gary muttered. Wrong answer, as he typed a few more words and disappeared. Immediately, he was back with 2 6-packs of Diet Pepsi. The bottles were short and fat, like oversized hand grenades made of glass. The sight of the old font and logo briefly took Martin back to when he was a child. Gary put the drinks down. He said,
"One more stop,"
then disappeared, reappearing with a fat stack of board games, paper plates, and a roll of paper towels. While eating the best bad pizza Martin had ever tasted and playing one of the most enjoyable games of Risk he had ever played, the five of them talked about a great many things. They talked about their choice of staff ornaments. Gary adorned his staff with large dolls of the band Kiss, tied to the staff so they faced outward. If one of the locals asked what they were, he would just say,
"The Demon, the Spaceman, the Starman, and the Peter Chris on drums."
Tyler's staff was topped by the hood ornament from a Rolls Royce. He didn't have a set explanation for its meaning, because a beautiful woman with wings speaks for itself. Jeff was the first wizard Martin ever met who opted for a wand instead of a staff. He said,
"It's easier to carry around, and I love me some Harry Potter."
They talked about where and when they were from. Gary was from Minneapolis, 1992. Tyler was from Montana, 2003. Jeff was from Delaware and came from the year 2021. Martin was briefly delighted to meet someone from the future. He asked Jeff what happened in the years between Martin's time and his.
A couple of presidents you've never heard of, a bunch of bands and movies you'd think are stupid. You'd freak right out if you saw my television. You'd love it, but you'd hate everything I watch on it.
Philip saw that this answer didn't please Martin and explained,
"We don't discuss the future, not because it'll damage reality, but because it'll damage our friendships."
"It just leads to a fight," Tyler said. "Anyone from before your time looks like a time capsule. Anyone from after looks like a privileged idiot. It's better to keep it vague. We figure if Jeff here had access to a computer and found the file, the future can't be too bad."
Jeff said,
"I promise, if there was anything too bad, I'd tell you everything my federally mandated cranial implant will allow me to say."
"What? Federally mandated cranial implant?" Martin said. There was a moment of tension. Then everyone but Martin laughed.
"That's the other reason we don't ask about the future. It's too easy to be made to look like a fool,"
Philip said.
"Yeah," Gary added. "Nobody wants to go through life looking like Ralph Wiggum."
Everyone laughed but Philip. They discussed what they did with their spare time. Gary was a painter. Mostly he painted the kinds of images that would make great covers for heavy metal albums. Lots of bat wings and fire. Martin said that he bet living in the Middle Ages gave him lots of inspiration.
"Not nearly as much as I'd hoped," he said. "Turns out life here is just as boring as it is in the future. If I wanted to paint subsistence farmers, I could have stayed in Minnesota. Tyler's getting a lot more inspiration out of this place than I am."
Martin turned to Tyler.
"What do you do?"
he asked.
"I write novels."
"Really?"
Martin said. "Anything I've read?"
"Doubtful. I've only finished one, and it wasn't published. There wasn't really a market for gothic horror."
Gary broke in.
"Especially one called The Ghost of the Wolfman's Mummy."
"It was called The Curse,"
said Tyler.
"And what was the subtitle?"
Gary prodded him. Tyler said,
"Of the Ghost of the Wolfman's Mummy."
"The Curse of the Ghost of the Wolfman's Mummy,"
Martin repeated, trying to get his head around it. Jeff said,
"It answered the age-old question. What would happen if a werewolf bit a pharaoh who was then mummified and whose tomb was defiled centuries later, causing him to come back to life and immediately get killed?"
Turns out what happens is 500 pages of confusion, gratuitous sex, and spooky growling noises, Gary said.
Tyler said, It was a great idea. To defeat the ghost of the Wolfman's mummy, you have to bring the ghost back to life. With a ritual that involves naked priestesses,
Jeff interjected.
Then gather all the funerary jars containing the mummy's organs,
Tyler continued.
By seducing them away from the beautiful, wealthy countess who bought them, Gary added.
Then, once you've destroyed the jars,
Tyler pressed on.
And had the sex to celebrate, Jeff said.
You still have a wolfman to deal with.
Tyler finally finished.
As sexually as possible, one would presume,
Philip said.
Are you writing another horror book?
Martin asked.
Nope, a fantasy novel. Living here has been invaluable. I travel around the countryside and ask people to tell me stories. Then I write them up and weave them into my narrative.
But Gary says it's mostly farmers around here.
It is. I adapt their stories.
Gary said,
Instead of farmer, he writes warrior.
And instead of carrot, he puts down goblin, Jeff added.
And instead of gru, he writes bludgeoned, Gary finished.
But the point is, I'm inspired by their stories,
Tyler said defensively.
Inspired to lie,
Philip said, not unkindly. There was a long pause while Martin tried to decide how to phrase the question they all knew was coming next. Finally, Martin asked,
Do the farmers ever react badly to the fact that you're
a black man in medieval England? Tyler finished for him. They ask about it, but I tell them I'm Moorish. They assume either I've been converted to Christianity, so I'm harmless, or I'm dangerous enough to survive in this country as a heathen. Either way, it ends the conversation.
Gary said,
The one here with the most interesting hobby is Jeff. He's one of the show's most prolific contributors. Easily a third of the things we can do are directly thanks to him. And what are you up to now?
Jeff shrugged.
Still working on importation.
Martin was lost.
Importation? What are you trying to import?
In theory, anything that was created digitally, but I'm specifically trying to bring in assets from video games. If they exist in a computer construct, and we exist in a computer construct, there should be a way to have us exist in the same computer construct.
Yeah,
Gary said, pounding his fist on the table.
Then we'll get some dragons up in here.
Tyler looked at Philip.
What I want to know is, what you do with your spare time? More to the point, what is it you keep on the second floor of your shop? Has he let you up there, Martin?
No, he hasn't.
Why not, Philip? What do you have up there?
Nothing,
Philip replied.
Then what do you do up there?
Tyler asked.
Nothing!
I see. You go up there to do nothing with nothing. Do you expect us to believe that?
No.
After a long pause, Tyler said,
Fair enough.
And they got back to their game of Risk.
So, Gary said, I bet you're anxious to get your own robes, eh, Martin?
Martin answered,
Can't wait.
We go back for the first fitting tomorrow,
Philip said.
Until then, he's welcome to wear my old robe. I don't really see the point myself. He's not doing magic in public yet.
I don't know, Martin said. I just feel safer if the locals think I have full wizard powers.
Nonsense! You've lived your whole life up until now without people thinking you have powers, and you haven't faced the constant threat of violence. I don't see why it should be any different here.
Because A, you clearly didn't go to my high school, and B, maybe I'm wrong, but I just get the feeling that there are some people around here who'd like to get their hands on a wizard who can't fight back.
Philip shook his head.
Nonsense, you're just being paranoid. But if it makes you feel better to wear my old robes, I see no harm in it.
The other three studied the game board in silence. Time went by. Battle lines were drawn and redrawn. Tyler had a run of luck and wiped Philip off of the map. Philip congratulated Tyler and handed over his cards. Tyler said,
Europe is the hardest continent to defend. Too many borders.
Perhaps,
Philip said, rising from the table.
Perhaps. Well, gents, I'm off to partake in the greatest pleasure the Middle Ages can afford, man.
Martin was confused until Jeff explained,
"He's going to take a whiz outside."
Philip had explained earlier that bathrooms were a matter of personal taste for wizards. All of the wizards Martin had met so far were male, so they were comfortable urinating outdoors. But one's chosen mode of defecation was largely determined by one's comfort level. Philip had facilities in his home similar to a modern bathroom. It was a small addition grafted crudely onto the back of his hut, and it resembled a classic latrine, except for three important factors. It had a modern toilet seat and lid, it had a roll of modern toilet paper, and it didn't have the horrible odor one expects in such a place. When Martin mentioned this, Philip used his staff to shine a light down the hole. It was a deep shaft that was bone dry all the way to the bottom. Martin asked if it was brand new. Philip laughed, wadded up a ball of the bathroom tissue, and threw it into the shaft. The ball fell down the shaft, then vanished into thin air a foot before the bottom.
"Where'd it go?" he asked Philip.
"Where I wanted it to,"
Philip answered. After a moment's thought, Martin asked,
"How deep is it?"
30 feet.
"Why so deep?"
"To build up speed."
Philip changed the subject, telling Martin about another wizard he knew, Tyler, as it turned out, who still kept an apartment in his original time. There was nothing unusual about that, but since he'd started living in the past, Tyler's apartment was basically a bathroom and a storage facility for bulk-purchased toilet paper, paper towels, hand soap, and garbage bags. He would commute back there every time he had to move his bowels. From his point of view, that meant every day or so, but since he always came back to the same moment he had just left, if you were in his apartment, you would see him appear, use the lavatory, wash his hands, dry them with paper towels, cloth towels wouldn't have time to dry, and disappear. Then, less than a second later, but hours or days later for him, he would appear and do the whole thing over again. Then again, and again, and again. Tyler had been a wizard for 4.5 years, so according to Philip's math, Tyler's toilet had been in near constant use for something like 5.5 days.
"His water bill's going to be astronomical," Martin said.
"Yes, in something like 20 years,
Philip said. Martin didn't know how Gary handled number twos, but when it came to urine, the answer was the forest outside, and that was where Philip was going. The instant he was gone, Jeff, Gary, and Tyler's demeanor changed completely. Tyler looked Martin straight in the eye and said,
"You aren't wrong, Martin. Don't ever let the locals think you can't defend yourself. Most of them don't care about us one way or the other, but there are some who'd love to catch one of us unaware."
Martin was both alarmed and relieved. He told them about the few seconds Philip had left him alone on the street and how close he came to getting attacked. They did not seem surprised.
"One time, I made the mistake of saying I'd broken my wand. A guy pulled a knife on me, like, immediately, like he'd been waiting to do it for years," Jeff said.
"What did you do?"
"I showed him that I'd glued my wand back together, then I showed him that it still worked, then I showed him my back from a great distance."
Tyler shook his head.
"They need us, and they fear us. That's not the same thing as liking or respecting us."
"Why doesn't Philip see that?"
Martin asked.
"He doesn't want to, I guess. He likes almost everyone, and he figures almost everyone likes him. It's worked out pretty well for him so far. I don't want to be there the day it stops. Who knows? Maybe it never will. It's hard not to like him."
Martin thought about the few days he'd known Philip. In that time, Philip had publicly humiliated him, bounced him off of a tree at high speed, threatened him with prison and public nudity, and repeatedly accused him of not thinking. And yet Martin trusted Philip and considered him a friend.
"You said he likes almost everyone," Martin said.
Gary smirked.
"You haven't seen him and Jimmy together yet, have you?"
"Look, Martin,"
Tyler said,
"we're not saying you should live in fear. We're just saying to keep your guard up."
"Yeah, I get that," Martin said.
He glanced at the door. The guys seemed to be leveling with him. He had a question he wanted to ask before Philip returned.
"Guys, should I be worried about passing the trials?"
They all looked at each other. Tyler said,
"You should work hard and do what Philip says. He trained Gary, and Gary trained me and Jeff. Philip knows what he's talking about. Do what he tells you and take it seriously. That said, I think you'll pass."
"Yeah, you'll pass," Gary said.
Because if you don't, we're totally going to send you back to your own time, tied up and naked.
Jeff added, helpfully.